Hi everyone, and welcome back to the program. We are joined here by John Mersheimer and Alexander Mercuris to discuss some of the issues now taking place, primarily between the United States, but obviously also involving Ukraine, as the two leaders might meet in Budapest. So it's good to have the both of you back.
Very nice to be here, Glenn.
We
Excellent to be here.
It is interesting. It seemed like we were walking back from the brink. That is, Trump at least said he was going to send Tomahawks to Ukraine, which seemed like a crazy escalation, given that these would have to be operated by Americans. And also, they could carry a nuclear warhead, and the Russians warned they would treat it accordingly, which, yes. Is quite an escalation. Yet Trump has walked this back, instead meeting now with Putin in the Budapest, or at least that is the plan, unless it's been cancelled. And the reaction in Europe as we walk away from the threat of a nuclear holocaust and instead embrace diplomacy is, utter panic. Poland said they might intercept Putin's plane if it goes through Poland. In the UK, they're talking about sending troops now to Ukraine. Sweden's defense minister, he said they have to go, Europe has to go into war mode because we should prepare for war with Russia. I mean, every few decades, it looks like the Europeans prepare for some collective suicide. I was thinking a good place to start would be what to expect from this meeting if it does take place. Will this be another Alaska, or should we expect something more from Budapest?
Let me just say a word before I ask Alexander to answer that specific question. When I look at what's happening, it seems to me that the Russian position remains unchanged. As we all three have said on numerous occasions, the Russian position on negotiations has been the same from the get-go. At the same time, if you look at the Ukrainian position and the European position, those remain unchanged as well. Nothing changes there. The only person who seems to change his view, sometimes on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis, is President Trump. And he moves all over the place. And I think what happened was that the Russians were obviously very nervous about the idea of us giving tomahawks to the Ukrainians. So what they did, and the Americans were willing to go along with this, obviously, is to arrange a telephone conversation between Putin and Trump the day before Trump was supposed to meet with Zelensky. There was no way that was not going to lead to a situation where Trump would tell Zelensky he can't have tomahawks. So that was a big win for Russia. But again, we get back to Donald Trump because he's the moving factor in this story. And in that case, in terms of the meeting with Zelensky and the meeting the day before, or the conversation the day before with Putin, what happened is that Trump went back to a position that was more sympathetic to the Russians, which didn't appear to be the situation that existed before his conversation with Putin. And now what's happening is all sorts of pressures being brought to bear on Trump to move back in the other direction. And this has been going on and on for a really long time, but it doesn't really matter very much in terms of the outcome of the war, because as the three of us have said many, many times, this one's going to be settled on the battlefield.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, there's a. I have to say, I have a depressing sense of deja vu about this whole latest affair. I mean, we've been here so many times. I mean, if we go back to the previous summit, the Alaska summit, there was all the threats. It seemed as if we were heading towards massive sanctions against Russia, tariffs against China and India, sort of economic war, not just against the Russians, but against much of the world as well. And we had deadlines, and then we had more deadlines, and then the deadlines shifted backwards and forwards. And then suddenly, out of the blue, we have Week Golf turns up in Moscow, and then there's discussions, and there's a summit meeting, and we don't hear any more about the sanctions. And then we're told there's been all kinds of progress, all kinds of things have been agreed. And as John absolutely correctly says, it doesn't look as if the Russians, in reality, shifted or changed their position at all. And then the Europeans and the Ukrainians got talking to Trump, and we started to see Trump move over again back to their side. And then we got a new threat, a new idea, the Tomahawk missiles going to Ukraine. And again, we have, well, not perhaps a deadline exactly, but a moment of truth, which was the meeting between Zelensky and Trump. And then again, we have this time a telephone call, and suddenly that's all off, and we have another summit meeting. But again, it's clear that nothing has been agreed, nothing has been decided, there's no real preparation going on. Rubio and Lavrov talked, and the reports say the discussion didn't go terribly well, and all the signs are that we're going to revert back in a couple of days back to Trump saying how disappointed he is in Putin and how things aren't turning out to be quite as straightforward as he expected. And we're going to have another swing back again. I think people on every side are becoming very tired of this. I think the Russians are getting very tired of it. Certainly the Europeans are. You're seeing commentaries in the British media, certainly, about this. And I think the general sense that's beginning to grow is that Trump does move backwards and forwards one way and the other, but in the end, nothing changes. Everything remains exactly the same. We always end up in exactly the same point that we were in previously. No real negotiations, no real discussions. The war goes on.
Let me ask the two of you a question based on everything you just said, Alexander. I agree that nothing changes at the diplomatic rhetorical level. It's just, you know, the eternal return of the same, right? But the fact is, as both of you know very well, things are changing on the battlefield, right? The Russians are winning the war, and the Ukrainians are in real trouble. And I think it's fair to say, and I know both of you agree with this, that it gets worse and worse every day for the Ukrainians. And at some point, the Russians are going to win this war, or the Ukrainian forces are going to collapse. But as we approach that point, as it becomes clearer and clearer, what do you anticipate that the Ukrainians and the Europeans will do at that point in time?
Well, Alexander.
Well, I was just going to say it's an excellent question, because that is clearly what is happening on the battlefields.
Yeah.
But there is no admission of this. If you go to the way in which European officials talk, Ukrainian officials talk, it's as if that wasn't happening, that we're in a stalemate, that the Russians are bogged down. So when that moment arrives, when it becomes undeniable, I am not sure that there is a plan anywhere in Europe about what to do at that point. I don't know whether the Europeans are misleading themselves or deluding themselves about this. I don't know whether maybe at some level deep down inside in the bureaucracies, somebody might be talking. We've had the former head of the British Army, who is widely considered to be Britain's best general. He's basically given an interview to The Independent, which one of our newspapers, in which he's basically saying, let's actually start to think and talk about these ideas. There's an article today in the Financial Times that maybe the moment has come to start contacts with the Russians. But, you know, all of this happens very, very much on the margins. I don't know anybody in government, in London, in Paris, and of course you've got political problems in these capitals, in Germany, who is actually addressing the situation that John has just described. So I don't think they themselves have any idea what to do. And I don't think they're, at the moment, even admitting the reality to each other. Glenn, I interrupted you.
No, I just think the Europeans are in a bit of a dilemma because they can't accept a defeat. And also, this is the whole idea of why they need to pull the Americans in, the assumption that if America makes a decision to fight or defeat Russia, then, you know, the weapons will somehow pop up. It's all a matter of political will. It just seems to me that the way the Europeans behave, because they want to negotiate an end to this from a position of strength, that is, if the military situation gets worse, then they're beating their chest even louder to kind of make up for it. So showing that they're ready to fight Russia, they're going to go into this industrial production, go into war mode. Oh, we're going to bring down Putin's flight. I mean, we're going to have to be real tough here to, you know, to balance out how poorly things are going. But no, this has been my question for the past 3 years. What happens when the war is lost? Because it's a war of attrition. It ends when one side runs out of soldiers. When there's no more army, there's no more war. And at this point, you either need one radical escalation or you need to accept defeat. I just feel that we've gone so deep down this hole, especially since the Americans decided to walk it back a bit. The Europeans wanted to overcommit to show to the Americans that they could carry their own weight. We just double down over and over again. So I can't really tell anymore. I get the impression it's still undecided. It can go both ways. They might do something crazy, or they can accept a defeat. But again, in defeat, it's not going to be a pretty peace either. If Ukraine collapses, it's going to be a very humiliating defeat. The Russians will impose their will. Again, it's going to be a messy, if not ugly, peace. And on the other hand, there's no peace that Europeans can accept either. So I think I don't think anyone really has a plan. There's just, you know, just keep the war going. And if we get through the day, then that's it. That's something. It sounds ridiculous, but you go through the statements. There's no strategic thinking. There's no objective, no discussing how to achieve those objectives. We're going to defeat the Russians. You know, what exactly does this mean? What do we see coming out of this? We increasingly realize we can't, NATO can't expand. Ukraine can't get its territory back. Russia will likely win. But there's no discussion in terms of, you know, with this in mind, how we can arrive at the most favorable possible spot there is. So I don't think there's anyone behind the wheel, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
But the thing is, Glenn, what we're talking about here is a situation where the Ukrainians are clearly losing. Nobody can deny it. The army on the front lines is beginning to collapse. That's not to say Russia's then going to conquer all of Ukraine, but it's on the march. It's conquering more territory. The Ukrainians can hardly put up any defense, and people in the West can no longer continue to behave in the delusional manner that they have been behaving in recent years. And so you say they may escalate, they may do something crazy, but my question is, what can they do? What's the option here? They've searched for every possible military option. You know, that's why there's all this attention on the Tomahawks now. The Tomahawks are the magic weapon. This is a joke. If Tomahawks were such a great weapon, why weren't they talking about Tomahawks a year ago or 2 years ago? It's, you know, sort of the last arrow in the quiver. And it, as Putin has said, and as we all know, it's not going to make much difference. It's not going to affect the outcome hardly at all. And if the Russians are winning, I mean, escalation on their part doesn't matter much. They're winning. So I just don't see where the Europeans are going to go. And if you stay in the fight, you know, even though you're losing, you just try and string it out for as long as you can. All that means is more of Ukraine is going to be lost to the Russians. More Ukrainians are going to die. Don't you reach a point here where the Ukrainians and the Europeans have to negotiate with the Russians? Or if that's not the case, it just seems to me the Russians are going to take more territory and kill more Ukrainians.
I think one of the points that bears repeating perhaps an understanding is that when we talk about the Europeans, we are not talking about a single entity like the United States with a single government where things can be talked and argued about. And sometimes occasionally people come to a decision. The Europeans are not going to be united about this. There are cracks in Southern Europe, in Italy, in Spain, in Greece, which of course I know, there is one view about the war. And there, I think, there would be great reluctance to escalate. And there, probably, they would say, well, look, this has gone as far as it can. Let's see whether we can talk to the Russians and whether we can find some kind of way out. Other people in other parts of Europe might take a completely different view. The Baltic states, which for some unaccountable reason seem to hold an extraordinary sway on European policy, which I don't myself understand, they, of course, will want any kind of escalation that they can imagine. They will be joined in that by some other people in Northern Europe, probably. And there will be all sorts of other people in the middle. One of the reasons why it is so difficult, in fact, impossible politically, to discuss alternatives, to look forward, to say, well, we're losing the war and we need to think how to find ways to deal with that problem. And that might mean being realistic about what we can do and the need to negotiate with the Russians. The problem with doing that is that the moment that happens, the entire appearance of European unity collapses. And that is something that the Europeans collectively are terrified of permitting. If they start discussing possible outreach to the Russians or any kind of diplomatic strategy, the whole structure will basically collapse into argument. And that makes any kind of forward thinking and approach impossible. The risk is that that's going to continue even beyond that moment when we see the collapse in Ukraine. And there will still be a reluctance for people to break out of line and to start saying, look, we've got to talk, we've got to find a way. So we could end up in a situation where we actually do nothing at all. The Russians continue to advance and there is no attempt to come to any sort of understanding with them, at which point everybody's left with the worst possible outcome, the Russians with a destroyed Ukraine on their west border, the Europeans with a defeat that they have no real plan how to handle, and a crisis on their eastern border, and of course the United States left to pick up the pieces and not perhaps knowing how, and perhaps not even wanting to. So that I think is the risk we run.
You know, I hadn't thought of this until you just made those comments, Alexander, but I think what you're saying is that if the Ukrainians do lose on the battlefield, they visibly lose, the army begins to collapse, what you're saying, in effect, is the centrifugal forces that are already at play in Europe will speed up. And if anything, there won't be a unified European position or anything close to it. In fact, you'll be moving in the other direction. And of course, if you marry that to the fact that the United States, and here we're talking about the Trump administration, would like to divorce itself from Europe and take the responsibility for dealing with Ukraine off America's shoulders and put it on Europe's shoulders, and here's Europe sort of disintegrating politically, this is, in a very important way, a catastrophic situation for Europe.
You've summed it up perfectly. That's exactly what I'm saying.
This isn't really hypothetical anymore. We're not talking necessarily a year from now. If we look at the front line now, we see Pokrovsk, almost more than half of it just falling apart. and the rest seems to follow. We have Kupiansk, Siversk, Liman. The Russians entered Konstantinovka. The last 24 hours, you have this whole Zaporozhye front restarting. It is the intensification along the front line is quite dramatic. But I agree with the assessment of you, Alexander, that this is that the unity in Europe is a big issue. It's worth remembering that when we had the NATO-Russia Council, this was always a key element. Why it didn't work? Because the NATO countries first had to get everyone together, and then they had to come up with a common position, which is very difficult, even when you have the Americans in the room who tends to, herd the group nonetheless. But then once they meet with the Russian with a common position, they can't move anywhere. And, the former Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi, he once referred to the EU as a giant with clay feet. Once it tries to move, it falls apart. And I think that also applies to this war. I mean, we kind of shocked everyone. Everyone got shocked after the Russians invaded. We overwhelmed our population with this vicious war propaganda. We put, the crazies in charge, like Kaya Kallas. You know, she should represent Europe now, apparently. And we all got on board unity against the evil Russian opponent. But if you would begin to switch now, I mean, the Baltic states, are they're not going to embrace diplomacy. Poland, no. But also, if there's an out, if you can start to talk peace, I guess the threat is that if peace risks breaking out, countries from Greece to Spain, they might jump on board of the peace train of Hungary, Slovakia, in which now the Czech Republic might start to board as well. We risk in peace to fragment Europe. But this is geopolitical Europe. Our unity is no longer based on prosperity. That's gone out the window. Now it's the Russian enemy. And so what could add? We also dipped into the Russian savings, which we took. So if there's a peace, we have to start paying back the money. There's a lot of problems coming our way.
I can make one other point, just sort of switching to the other side, to the Russian side. I mean, I think the Russians are obviously doing very well on the battlefield. They're paying a price, of course, because that's inevitable in a war of attrition. But they're doing very well, much better than the Ukrainians, as we were saying. But I also think if you move away from what's happening on the battlefield and you sort of go to the, let's call it the diplomatic rhetorical level, Putin is actually doing very well there as well. You want to remember that one of the goals of the West from the start was to isolate Putin. And of course, they failed miserably in that regard, especially with regard to countries like China and India. And if you look at what's recently happened with India, if anything, Trump's policies on tariffs vis-a-vis India has driven the Indians closer to the Russians. And the Chinese and the Russians, of course, are very close. So Putin looks good there. But you also want to remember that Putin went to Alaska. He set foot in the United States. Now he is presumably going to Budapest. He's going to Hungary. That's a country that's in the European Union and is in NATO. Just want to think about that. And furthermore, Putin, he plays along with Trump. Putin surely understands that Trump is a loose cannon, and he says things that are, at first blanch, very offensive to Putin and the Russians. But Putin plays nice with them. Putin understands there's absolutely no point in retaliating. And what Putin wants to do is look diplomatic and look reasonable and look smart and look informed and look coherent. And whether you like Putin or not, he is brilliant at all those things. He just does a great job. So Putin looks like the only adult in the room, at least to me, and I think to increasing numbers of people. I know it's true for both of you as well. When you compare him to Trump and the European leaders, there's just no comparison. So Putin is not only in a situation where he's doing very well on the battlefield, he's also doing very well at what I call the diplomatic slash rhetorical level.
I think that's absolutely true. I think the one thing I would say is that Putin, who I think does have a realistic understanding of things, probably would optimally like a US president or indeed some leader in Europe, one of the big countries who he could work with in order to try to chart the way towards a long-term solution to this problem, because Putin understands and understands very well, and the Russians, I'm sure, understand very well that even if they win a victory in Ukraine, when they win a victory in Ukraine, they are going to still be faced with a mass of unresolved problems that are going to stretch out into the future. So I think that Putin, absolutely, he's played this whole game of diplomacy with the West with extraordinary skill. He has won a lot of respect, and I think that is the right word, around the world because of it. He's consolidated his status in China, in the Middle East. He's going to India in a few weeks. But he must understand at some level that the weakness and chaos in the West, and it's important to say, by the way, we're talking about the problems, the fractures in Europe, that in France and Britain, in France, we have a political crisis. In Britain, we are on the brink of one. In Germany, the political situation there doesn't look terribly stable either. Putin, I think, probably understands that that, in a sense, is a problem for him, and it is a problem that in the United States, he doesn't have a president like, well, Kennedy or Nixon, two profoundly different people, but somebody who the Russians could talk to.
But here, I have a question for you, Alexander, and for you as well, Glenn. If you're playing Putin's hand, do you have a vested interest in exacerbating those tensions in Europe, driving the Europeans apart and not allowing them to come together and form a coherent whole? Or do you have the opposite interest, which is to do everything you can to work with them and foster some sort of coherent Western policy so you can cut a deal? You can make an argument on both sides.
Well, I'll just answer that question before Glenn, because I just want to say my own thing. I think Putin understands that he has to deal with the European leaders and the American leaders that he has. And ideally, he would prefer a de Gaulle or a Brandt in Europe, or as I said, a Kennedy or a Nixon in the United States, with whom he could come to an understanding. In the absence of that, a situation where there is a deepening crisis, political crisis in Europe, and where Europe fragments is obviously preferable to him and Russia than a situation where they all coalesce together and become more threatening to Russia itself. So, in that respect, yes. In exacerbating the divisions does play to his advantage, but I don't think optimally that is what he would prefer to see.
I agree. I think, well, just first on the Hungarian issue, I was reading it the same way, that how it strengthened the hand of Hungary. Because keep in mind, Hungary within Europe has become almost a pariah state, because Orban went to Kiev, he went to Moscow, he tried to get the diplomacy going again long time ago, and the Europeans or EU punished him for it. So the fact that now he's a representative for Europe in the eyes of Washington and as well Russia, it's not great for the EU, which has been seeking to isolate him because he didn't fall in line. So he has to be isolated. Now the Russians and Americans are essentially elevating him. So it's no, it's yeah, it's an interesting move. But in terms of having an objective to split up the Europeans, I think instinctively it would be a good move for Russia, given that well, our main unity now is against the Russians. But I mean, geography doesn't change. If you have a too humiliated loss for the too great humiliation on part of the Europeans, if the peace becomes too ugly, I don't think it would be necessarily something that would create stability in Europe. And Russia has some poor history with political instability in Europe, how that spills over to Russia. I still think that this is going to end on the battlefield. So whatever happens in Hungary, it's going to end up in ending up on the battlefield. However, I don't think it's necessarily written in stone. I think if the Russians could, I mean, the most difficult things for the Ukrainians to accept a peace now is the territorial issues, and the Donetsk, of course, that they have to pack up and leave. Big cities like Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, which they still hold, it's a bit over the top. I don't even if the public would accept it, it would be too difficult for the nationalists and the other groupings within. I think that, however, if you would see Trump suddenly begin to speak about an end to NATO expansion and deal with the basic security architecture issues, which the Russians have been hammering on about for 30 years, they might be willing to make some concessions on other areas. Because keep in mind, at one point, Keith Kellogg was even on TV, was making the point, of all people, Keith Kellogg, making the point that in an agreement, it might the issue of NATO expansion might have to extend to Moldova and Georgia. This, I mean, if something like this was on the table for the Russians, if they control one or two cities less, I don't really think that would be the overarching issue. So I haven't really given up on the peace issue yet, but if the Europeans are coordinating to, if they find unity in opposing Russia, I think it would make common sense to try to sow divisions.
See, one problem I think that the Russians face is if they cut a deal in which they make certain concessions to the West, they're not as ambitious in terms of territorial goals as they could be. In other words, they can conquer more territory, but they don't do it because they want to facilitate a deal. The problem that they face is what happens if they cut a deal and then in 2 years, Trump or somebody else changes his or her mind? And Russia's not necessarily back to square one, but in bad shape. What I think is that the Russians now have very powerful incentives to pursue maximalist goals. I think you want to grab all the territory you can. You want to go to great lengths to make sure that Ukraine is a dysfunctional rump state. You want to do everything you can to make sure that the West and that dysfunctional Ukrainian rump state are as far apart as possible. If you're the Russians, you've played this game where you trusted the West, right? You got involved in serious negotiations with regard to the Minsk Accords, and look what the West did to you. You just can't trust these people. And especially if you look at Donald Trump, who in God's name would trust anything that Donald Trump says? He changes his views all the time, right? And so I think one of the real problems here in settling this war is that I think deep down inside, the Russians understand. And you see it with some of the spokes. People like Medvedev, they understand that they have to grab it all. Not all of Ukraine, but all they can get before they begin to run into trouble.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the Russians talk about this with themselves. I mean, it is, if you go to Russian social media places, I mean, it's a constant topic of discussion there. How can we trust the Americans? How can we trust the Europeans? And even Putin has acknowledged it on several occasions. And this problem of trust is a huge one. And it's not easy to see what guarantees the Americans and the Europeans could ever give to the Russians, which could not be withdrawn and which the Russians would be able to take away and accept and say to themselves, absolutely, this is something we can rely upon, and it's going to settle the situation in the future. It is a massive problem. What I will say, however, is that there is still an influential current of opinion, I believe, in Russia. And I believe that Putin himself is a part of it, which says, well, yes, all of this is true, but unless we can come to some kind of understanding, maybe not with the Europeans, where it may be hopeless, but with the Americans, who have more agency and have many more reasons, because they're so committed in so many places around the world, to stick to what we agree with, unless we come to an agreement with them, then we are guaranteeing to us for ourselves further problems in the future. And let's try instead and see whether we can find a way out. And I think that's one of the reasons, by the way, why Putin and other Russian officials go to such extraordinary lengths to maintain a dialogue with Trump, because at least he's speaking to them, and they might be able, they think, to discuss these things with him and maybe plant seeds, which even if Trump won't take them forward, perhaps a future American president might.
I'm interested in what you two think would be the minimum goals of the Russians in terms of territory. Do you think the four oblasts plus Crimea would satisfy them? Or do you believe that there are a handful of other oblasts, especially Odessa and Kharkiv, that they definitely feel they have to have? I mean, what's your sense from following Russian discourse as to what the minimum set of territorial goals are?
Well, I think, again, it's a bit... I'm uncertain because they're not open about their negotiation position. So I think, well, at least my impression is that there's no negotiations on Donbass. Again, they hold Lugansk, but Donetsk is key. That is, they have to get all of this, and the two main cities remaining then will be Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. But I think I'm more optimistic on the willing to make concessions, perhaps, than you, Alexander. That is, I do think that they would be willing to forego some of the territories that do not yet hold in Zaporizhia and Kherson. I don't think they would ever dream about walking away from any of the territory they already have, but they might accept, for example, sticking with the territory of Kherson on their bank of the Dnieper. But again, I might be mistaken in this, but it would depend on if the source of the war could be resolved. And I get the trust issue. There's no trust, and they'd be foolish to trust the Europeans as well, because at the moment, as we speak, the Europeans keep saying that, well, maybe a ceasefire would be good because Ukraine has been exhausted. They need to replenish the ranks. We need time to build more weapons and send them. You know, imagine if we can fill up Ukraine with long-range missiles, then this could never happen again, this kind of idea. So I this is essentially what Minsk was about. We make a peace deal, and then incrementally we change realities on the ground. We build a huge Ukrainian army, then we can start to redo some of the things, like take back Crimea. And I think this is what... Why they don't trust it. But if they had some agreements from all of NATO, which guarantees that there won't be an incrementalism, because this is the key of NATO. If it's the missile defense, if you remember this originally, we're just going to have 10 interceptor missiles in Poland. They'd be crazy to fear it. But then it incrementally grows. It's the same with NATO expansions. It was the same with the troop levels in Ukraine. Everything just grows slowly in order not to provoke too immediate and harsh pushback from the Russians. So if they could have some deal, no weapons, being no Western weapons in Ukraine, no boots in Ukraine, no de facto membership, nothing, I think the Russians would want to put an end to this, especially if they, over time, can build up their strength in their position, but Ukrainians cannot. Then worst case, if the conflict is revived again in 5 years, then the Russians would stand strong while the Ukrainians will probably be much, much weaker.
I have modified my views about this, and I think this has become increasingly clear, to me at least, over the course of this year since Trump became president. I think the moment Trump appeared and started to at least float the possibility of a negotiated solution, I think that the Russians themselves have been probably thinking and talking and discussing this thing with each other. And I'm going to say, I don't think they've come to a complete view. So I think there are some people, like sections of the military, who say, we must have the four regions and we must have more. So recently, a few weeks ago, the chief of the Russian General Staff, General Gerasimov, he appeared, and there was a map behind him on the wall, which showed Odessa and the whole Black Sea coast of Ukraine as part of Russian territory. And I suspect that there is a view within Russia, and perhaps especially within the military, who say, look, this is what we must have. This is Russian land. Those are Russian people. We should bring them all in and bring them together. There are others who say, well, look, it's the four regions. They're part of Russia. We stick there. That's what we decided and agreed last year when and what Putin set out when he addressed the foreign ministry, and we accept the four regions, and then we come to an agreement about everything else. And then again, I think that there is a third current, which is Putin himself, possibly, and some of his officials. And they're saying exactly the things that Glenn is saying. And they say, look, Donetsk, Lugansk, this is non-negotiable. They're just too important. They're the core territory that this whole conflict ultimately was about. The land bridge to Crimea is also core territory. We're never going to give that up. But other parts, other places in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, which we don't yet occupy, let's be flexible about these. If we can get all of these other things, if we are going to be able to get guarantees that NATO is not going to be expanded eastward, that there's not going to be the build-up of the Ukrainian army in the future, if we're not going to see attempts to basically turn Ukraine into a real problem for us, well, we can forgo Zaporozhye and Kherson, two cities. They're not as important to us as achieving those things. So I think that current of opinion exists as well. And I'm starting to get the sense that Putin himself shares this. Notice that over the last couple of months, the Russians have not been talking so much about the territorial issue. Lavrov, Putin himself, they've been saying territory is not for us the key issue. It is the rights of Russians in Ukraine, their ability to speak their language, to have all of the rights that people have. Those are the things that really matter. And that does suggest that at least some people in Moscow, and I think Putin himself, are prepared to be a bit more flexible on the territorial issue, provided, of course, all of the other things can be addressed.
I would just say, Alexander, that I think how the Russians think now, when there's very little movement on the battlefield, I mean, there is movement, I don't want to minimize it, but there's not major movement at this point in time. And the Ukrainian army has not collapsed is a very different situation than one where the Ukrainian army falls apart. I think if the Ukrainian army falls apart, the Russians are likely, I'm not saying for sure, we're speculating, of course, I think the Russians are likely to find that their appetite grows, because at that point it will be easy to take all of Zaporozhye, all of Kherson, and maybe even think about going into places like Odessa. And as you know, they're already moving into other oblasts besides those four, Kharkiv being one. Dnipro being another. So the Russians are, you know, conquering territory. And if the floodgates were to open, I would imagine that they'll grab a lot more territory. And again, the reason is they're now in a good position. They will not be in a good position in 2 or 3 years. You have an opportunity in front of you, and you're dealing with duplicitous people, people you can't trust. And you have a deep-seated interest in making sure that Ukraine is really weak. I mean, I sound like I'm talking in very ruthless ways, but if you're the Russians and you feel like you've been betrayed by the West and you've fought this bloody war where lots of Russians have died, I think you're going to be quite hard-hearted in your thinking about what to do moving forward.
I don't disagree because, well, it's more than 20 years now since the Orange Revolution. So this is not, you know, one little issue which has to be solved. We've had more than 20 years now trying to pull Ukraine into the NATO orbit. So I don't think there's any trust. I do think that they believe for very good reasons that the at least Europeans will try to still pull the Ukrainians into the NATO orbit. And also, I think if, as you say, the war continues and there is a collapse and the Russians can march forward at great speed, I don't think only Odessa. I think Kharkov, Dnipro, Nikolaev, and Odessa, those four regions, they would definitely go for it because, well, then they could guarantee the way they see the language, cultural, and religious rights of them. But also, this is where most of the strategic territory, this is the entire coastline, this is where the main resources, and that's not just great for Russia, but it's also great because that's a key appeal, maybe not the main, but it's a key appeal for the Europeans and the Americans. There's a reason why we want Ukraine into our orbit. So if you strip it of all the nice parts, again, sounds very crude, but then there will be less interest from NATO in terms of returning to Ukraine, trying to have another go at it. So I very much agree with it. I just think if the conflict is still going, the Ukrainian army hasn't collapsed yet, the Russians know there will never be another Trump as a president, unless J.D. Vance, who's willing to actually talk to them and consider their concerns. I think, for the sake of peace, because who knows, 6 months from now, things can change. The drone technologies can change. The economic situation in the world could change. The position of the Indians could change. I mean, there's all the other variables won't remain constant. So I think if there is a possibility now to strike a deal, yes. But as the Russians have kept saying over and over again, if the longer you wait, the worse the deal will be. And I do think this, if there's a bit of a collapse now, they're going to take some more territory. Even Arestovich, the former advisor of Zelensky, made this point. He said, I would give up four regions because the alternative is eight. And I know exactly which four other regions the Russians would seize. So, I don't disagree. I just think if there's a deal today or in Budapest next week, I think the Russians would make some compromises if there would be something to guarantee this, that it's not just another temporary pause before we get back into restarting the Ukraine war.
Go ahead, Glenn.
No, I would just say, I mean, it's two very quick things. Firstly, there's also Russian opinion to take account. I mean, if you can take place like Kharkov or Odessa or Kherson and you don't, you have to explain why, and that might not be easy in Russia. And if you do take these places, realistically, you're not going to give them back. And going back to what Glenn is saying, that shows that we have only a very limited time window now, because the Russians are going to take Donbass very soon. And once they've taken Donbass, I'm going to say very soon, in a couple of months' time maybe, but they will take it. Once that is done, then exactly coming back to your earlier point, they might be less willing to make territorial concessions. And with every day that passes, making territorial concessions becomes less and less likely. And in fact, the point will come when it won't be possible at all.
You know, Glenn, you were mentioning Moldova and Georgia before. and the possibility of NATO expansion into them. And I think Alexander was also saying, maybe it was you, Glenn, that the Orange Revolution was over 20 years ago. I would note that we fought, excuse me, the Russians fought a war over Georgia, NATO expansion into Georgia in 2008. And here we are saying that's still an open possibility. And if you look at what's happening in Moldova, right, it's very clear that the West is deeply interested in turning Moldova into a Western bastion on Russia's doorstep. And there's Transnistria, and it's right next to Ukraine, and so forth and so on. Again, the incentives to take Odessa just begin to go up when you start thinking about the world that you're facing as a Russian leader. And you, Glenn, talk about guarantees. You know, maybe they can give some solid guarantees. I would note to you, Glenn, you are a good realist, and you know as a good realist that giving guarantees in the international system is not something that works very well, because talk is cheap and we have nobody to enforce those guarantees. You can give the Russians a guarantee, but if the Americans or the Europeans or both of them welch on the guarantee, who's going to protect the Russians? And the answer is nobody. And again, that just gives the Russians a very powerful incentive to really grab all they can and to really make sure not only that they grab more territory, but that Ukraine is a dysfunctional rum state. You want it to be dysfunctional. This is why it would have made sense, as Aristovich said, to get on an airplane, go to Moscow, and cut a deal right away and make it a sweetheart deal for the Russians. Yeah. This is a repellent idea in the West. Oh, my God, go to Moscow and give the Russians pretty much everything they want. How could anybody possibly think that except morally bankrupt people like us? But, of course, that's ridiculous. If this war isn't settled immediately, the Ukrainians are going to lose a lot more. And cutting a deal now that's generous to the Russians and does everything to solve the commitment problem that you were describing, Glenn, is what makes sense.
But if there's if there's opportunity opening for the Russians to take Nikolaev and Odessa, they not only have then the whole Black Sea and well in the northern parts, that is that NATO can't expel Russia anymore from the Black Sea, which is a key concern, but also connect them with Moldova, which means that the efforts of canceling the autonomy of
Transnistria.
Sorry, Pridnestrovia was in my head, and swinging Moldova into NATO. I mean, all of this could be canceled. So it would be a great prize in terms of also preventing future conflicts from Moscow's perspective. So this is why I'm saying we should get on the first plane to Moscow, because now is, as Alexander suggested, the window opportunities is closing. If we can give them this sweetheart deal, and you know, Trump wants to completely transform U.S.-Russian relations from the past 100 years, and you know, I know there's a lot of distrust in Russia, but but this is the last chance, I think. Yeah, as you said, whatever we do that creates more distrust, then I think they'll go for these territories. But I think time is of the essence, which I can't understand why the Europeans just want to, you know, fight another day, because every day the Ukrainians grow closer to a collapse and the Russians get one step closer to just seizing whatever they want.
Well, you took the point I was about to make out of my before I could say it. I mean, if you were trying to create a rational policy for the Europeans, much more for the Europeans than for the Americans, they will be getting right behind Trump, and they will be contacting Moscow, and they will say, please, please, have this summit meeting in Budapest. And they would be saying to Zelensky, You must now agree to this because time is of the essence and time is short. And do you really want to put Kharkiv and Kherson and Odessa and Nikolaev and all of these places at risk? Do you understand that if you lose them, you are never getting them back? And think of what will happen to Ukraine. Instead of doing those things, we are doing the exact opposite. We are supporting Zelensky and his officials in their intransigence. And it's extraordinary to see. I mean, you know, one can explain it. I mean, I've tried to provide my explanation for it earlier in the program. But that doesn't take away from the complete bankruptcy of statesmanship that it actually shows. One would have thought that someone somewhere in Europe, apart from Orban, would be able to see this thing clearly and would be arguing in, you know, in private, in the chancelleries, here's the moment, we've got to seize this moment. The Russians are indeed at the gates of Pokrovsk. They might be pushing through the defense lines before very long. We don't have a huge amount of time. Ukraine can't go on much longer. Maybe it's got 6 months, maybe it's got a year. Who knows how long it will be? But unless we cut this deal now, we might not be able to get any outcome that would be in any way beneficial or even reasonable for ourselves. Until in Europe we rediscover the art of statesmanship, we're not going to do that. And here I have to say that over-dependence on the United States for so long has atrophied away our own ability to think these things through. If you compare the level of debate and discourse that takes place in the United States, patchy though that is, at least people in the United States talk about these issues. In Europe, because we've relied on the Americans for so long, especially since the end of the Cold War, we don't seem to be able to think these things through. And that's how someone like Kaya Kallas, for example, becomes the representative of European diplomacy.
Just a quick point on this to put it in a slightly broader context. What I find puzzling is if you go back to the 1990s, when the decision was made to expand NATO, it was made roughly 1994. And then the first tranche is 99, second big tranche is 2004. And of course, the Ukraine decision is 2008. But anyway, go back to the 1990s. There was huge opposition inside the Clinton administration and outside the Clinton administration to NATO expansion. You saw it at the time in public, and now a lot of the records have been released, and you can see it in the government records from the day. And by the way, it's clear in those government records that have now been released that they understood that Ukraine was the one place that was really dangerous. They understood, even the proponents of NATO expansion, that this was going to drive the Russians crazy. But going into Ukraine was going to be especially dangerous. Anyway, you had this big debate and the expanders won. But what I find remarkable is that the debate then completely disappeared. After 19, I'd say 95, there's hardly any debate at all, and certainly after 1999. And instead, in the United States, and of course because the Europeans drank American Kool-Aid, they mimicked these arguments. But after 1999, the idea that we had an open door policy on admitting countries to NATO, and it didn't matter what the Russians thought, and these sort of balance of power calculations that the opponents raised just didn't matter. That became almost like a religion, and nobody in the United States protested. Nobody in the United States or in Europe protested. It's really quite remarkable that more people weren't standing on the rooftops, especially after 2008. especially after the Georgia War in August of that year, especially after the Ukraine conflict breaks out in February 2014, that there aren't more people who are saying, we have to rethink this. Look at what's happening. We just had a war in Georgia, and now we're on the verge of another war in Ukraine. Ukraine has just lost Crimea. You would just expect that debate that took place in the United States in the 1990s to resurface in Europe and even in the United States. But that hardly happens at all. And it's just a band of characters like us, not a large community by any means. And most of us are marginalized. All of us are marginalized in very important ways from the mainstream media. We're the opposition. We were what George Kennan was, what William Perry was in Paul Nitzer, Gene Kirkpatrick, you name it, in the 1990s. But out there in the mainstream, you know, among people in the foreign policy elites on both sides of the Atlantic, it's actually quite stunning that there's hardly anybody who stands up and says the emperor has no clothes. And I don't have a good explanation for it. I believe many articles and books are going to be written on this. But I just find it quite amazing, especially given the disastrous consequences here. Look at what's happened. You know, we talk about Russia, we talk about the United States. Look at what's happened to Ukraine. This is a catastrophe. That's not an exaggeration. It's a catastrophe.
I found it in the 90s, how that disappeared, to be also interesting. I published a book last year on the Ukraine war, and I had a whole chapter just assigned pretty much to the 1990s around this debate, because it was such fierce, as you said, opposition. And even the anti-Soviet hawks, they would still, many of them would also come out and say, well, this Absolutely. Is just going to restart the Cold War. This is a very bad idea. And you had the giants from, you know, George Kennan, obviously, being the main one. But you mentioned William Perry. He even came out later on giving an interview back in 2016 when he said, well, it wasn't just him who was opposed to NATO expansion, who at least recognized that it would cause a disaster. But he was making the point. Everyone in the administration realized that this was going to be seen as a stab in the back for the Russians and they would come back angry. But as his point was, it's not that they rejected this argument. It's just that the rest of the Clinton administration thought it doesn't matter. The Russians are weak. They're getting weaker. Our relationship should be based on managing their decline, not accommodating their security concerns. And for example, Madeleine Albright, she was very pro expanding NATO, but she also recognized, yeah, the Russians are all feeling encircled. But if things go bad, at least NATO will be there. So, you know. It's quite extraordinary. I think that this amnesia is, again, it goes back to my comment before with the NATO-Russia Council. That is, we have this debate, we recognize that it's problematic, but we also recognize if we want the hegemonic peace, then NATO expansion is the key. Once the decision has been made, we put the debates behind us and we organize in solidarity around the narrative that no one has any reasons to fear NATO. It's an institution intended to promote democracy. And, you know, we all signed under and we all agree that this is the narrative we will now follow. And we forget all about those big debates in the 1990s. By the way, if you want to go through the Senate debates, if you look through the discussions they have and you look and you search up the word insurance guarantee. Something along those lines. We need a insurance policy. That's what NATO was. Let's expand NATO. If we have a future conflict with Russia, we'll have NATO. This was reoccurring. It was obvious it was against Russia as well, but in case we would have a conflict and to create this hegemonic Europe. But we forgot it completely. I think it's because if we would open up this box again, then the whole foundation of the European security architecture would come into place. So we all have to walk around, pretend it's not real, that the debates we had, the legitimate concerns of the Russians, you know, this is all stuff of Kremlin talking points that legitimizes Russia's bad behavior now. So it's a fascinating part of Western history that the whole decade kind of went into.
It's true. I mean, I don't have much to say to this, except that, I mean, it's part of the general change that has happened in politics altogether. I mean, you know, that kind of debate, the one that took place in the early 1990s in the United States, and of which, by the way, there was a similar debate in Britain, as I remember, at that time. That debate belongs more to the world that existed before the end of the Cold War. I mean, it was the sort of arguments that you had between doves and hawks. Of course, some of the people like Bolnitzer had been, and Jean Kirkpatrick were absolutely anti-Soviet hawks. But you had these kind of very high intellectual and intelligent and well-informed debates, and they used to play out in public, and they used to have an effect on policy. I can remember them. I'm sure we all can remember them during the Cold War. It was almost, in effect, the last one. And then something changed altogether, not just about that, but about so many other things. I mean, the disappearance of peace movements in Europe, for example, which I was never a part of, by the way, just to say. But I mean, I remember them, and they were very much part of the political landscape in Europe at that time. And so many other things, too. The way the media functions was completely different before. How it all changed, I don't know. I do think, and you know, without getting into a completely different topic, I think the events that started, you know, the conflicts in the Middle East, the war on terror, all of that, did perhaps lead to a closing of minds. The point is, we have to start opening our minds again, and we have to rediscover some of that ability to conduct debates in the way that we did previously, and not moralize and climb onto, you know, podiums and, you know, soapboxes and lecture people and make what we call moral judgments, which, because ultimately they're not based on any kind of reality, are not really moral at all, and lead exactly to the catastrophe which we're looking at today.
One additional point about NATO expansion, Glenn mentioned Madeleine Albright, which triggered in my mind the fact that I recently read Steve Kinzer, the journalist Steve Kinzer, who I think does brilliant work on all sorts of subjects, has written a book on Ukraine, the Ukraine war. And he goes back to the roots of the Ukraine war. And one of the central themes in the manuscript, I don't know exactly when the book is coming out, but I believe it's shortly. One of the central themes in Steve's book is that if you look at who most of the hawks are on NATO expansion, they have East European roots. Mm. People like Madeleine Albright, people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, and even people in the military, Democratic and Republican administrations, and so forth and so on. It's really quite impressive as you read through the book to see the extent to which expansion, NATO expansion into Ukraine, NATO expansion more generally, is fostered, strongly fostered by Americans who have East European roots.
Well, that was a common theme, though, that the whole idea after the Cold War, if we should remove the dividing lines, unify Europe, essentially in as outlined in the Charter of Paris for a New Europe, this is what we're supposed to. But you saw also from the Eastern European countries, then they didn't necessarily want an end to the dividing lines. They just wanted to be on the other side of the dividing lines. And instead of seeking reconciliation, which, for example, the French were looking for after the Cold War, you had coming out of Eastern Europe more calls for historical justice and almost revenge. But again, in Europe now, we're all Latvians, effectively. We're all seeking, you know, revenge on Russia. It's, but I think it's besides the hatred of Russia and seeking justice, there's a different thing that's gripped at least Europe. Alexander, you just mentioned the obsession with what they think is morality. It feels to me that normative statements is confused with morality in Europe these days. We just say things which sounds lovely. It's, you know, it's if I would say, oh, you know, Mexico has America's threatening Mexico with the drug cartels, and Mexico's every right in the world to host Chinese missiles. And this feels like the most moral thing in the world to say, because but in reality, in the realist world, you're condemning Mexico to death. So it's again, I don't understand anymore the political class on this continent.
I did. I think that's. I think that's completely right. I mean, it's unfortunately something that goes so unchallenged in Europe. I think this is true more in Europe than in the United States, that this kind of very moralistic language is very difficult to argue against, especially when it is made by people like people in Eastern Europe who do have legitimate grievances against Russia. We shouldn't forget this. I mean, they do have legitimate grievances against Russia, but constantly satisfying that sense of grievance, constantly appeasing it, instead of helping to find a way through, what it is doing all the time is making it worse and worse. Relations between the Russians and the Baltic states, as I remember, used to be much better in the 1990s, before they joined NATO, than they are today. Be and the Baltic states have become more and more aggressive towards Russia all the time, precisely because they feel that they obviously they have that grievance, but that the support that they're getting means that that grievance is not just justified, but it can be amplified and it can be supported with no consequences for themselves. And that has been disastrous, and it's fed us all in, and it has, to a disastrous degree, spread that sense of grievance right across Europe, with helping to bring about this crisis that we're in now.
I think Finland is even a better example. Finland survived the Cold War nicely, living next door to the Soviet Union, which was far more powerful in military terms than Russia is today. Finland had no problems with Russia after the Cold War ended. Then it joins NATO. Is this going to work to Finland's advantage over time? No, it's just going to exacerbate relations between Russia and Finland. It's going to make relations worse. And you see both sides talking about defending the border between the two countries, and then both countries are competing in the Arctic. And you say to yourself, how does that work? It was foolish, I think, for Sweden and Finland both to join NATO. And I agree with you completely, Alexander, with regard to the Baltic states. And then if you go to Poland, you look at the foreign minister, Sikorski. His basic view on how you deal with the Russians is you take a stick and you poke them in the eye at every opportunity. Does this really make sense? I mean, I understand that Poland's history is a dark history. I understand that it disappeared from the map between 1795 and 1918. Okay, but if you live in a dangerous neighborhood and you live next to a great power like Russia or the Soviet Union before that, I think poking it in the eye with a stick is usually going to be counterproductive. I think there are other ways to deal with the bear. But you can't sell that argument to lots of people in Eastern Europe. They think that, poking the bear in the eye is the way to go. And I think when you're small and weak and you live next door to a bear, you have to be much more prudent.
When I said we're all Latvians now, I didn't even mean to exaggerate. I mean, the Scandinavians are perfect in this as an example. The Swedish defense minister recently came out and made the point that, well, the reason we live next to Russia, the way what you've learned is you have to arm yourself to the teeth to survive, and you have to fight for your freedom. Well, that's not their experience at all. They became neutral, and they lived quite well. They had some instances of submarines, which were instigated a bit with by the British and Americans in order to try to lure them a little bit away to create, because they were concerned they had too much peace with the Russians or the Soviets at that time. Same as the Finns. Stubb was going to, was telling Trump that, oh, our experience with the Russians, you have to always deter them because this is the only way you can keep them at bay. But and even referenced, I think, the Winter War before World War II. But this is when the Soviets invaded Finland. But as we know, as all the documents show, the Soviets were afraid that the Germans would use Finland as a launching pad to attack the Soviet Union. A little bit, not a little bit, a lot like Ukraine today. And as a result, they invaded Finland to prevent Finland from being used as a bridgehead into the Soviet Union. And once after World War II, an agreement had been made to make Finland neutral. They lived with the huge border to the Soviet Union in peace, and they prospered. So, but now they make it sound like fighting Russia till the end is what this is the new history or what has made them prosperous and safe. It's just very strange, very strange history. I hear the same in this country, in Norway. They make this argument that, well, if you look at the Soviets, they never really liberated anyone in World War II. They might have pushed out the Nazis, but then they stayed behind themselves, which is fair. If you're a Polish person, you can say this. But in this country, the Russians came in, they liberated the northern parts, they buried their dead, and they went home. I mean, we don't have this. We're just all in reinventing our history and trying to, play the same role. It's very, very strange.
Glenn, people don't believe in getting into the details of history anymore in the way that you do. I mean, we get comments in the media here in Britain that when Putin brings up the history of Ukraine, what he sees as history, you don't actually respond to it or argue with it. You just roll your eyes and say, it's another history lecture and you can't take this into account. I mean, that is another problem, that we don't want to look into the past and understand it and discuss it. But there it is. I mean, we have to deal with this crisis that we have now. And that means, at least for the time being, putting all this to one side and focusing on the current problem. And you spoke about how Finland, they talk about the only way to secure your freedom and prosperity is by being armed to the teeth all the time because of the fear of the bear next door. Well, we've just been living through that. Very same thing. We are trying to arm ourselves to the teeth and not succeeding, and we're not getting very much prosperity. And well, I'm not going to discuss the issue of freedom. So this is not a way forward. It is a dead end, and we have to go back and do what we should have done much before. And try to find a diplomatic resolution to this crisis and find some way to live with the Russians before the window closes, which it will very soon. If the Russians get across the river, if they cross the river in force, if they start moving westwards, then frankly, I mean, all the discussions that are taking place about diplomacy and all of that, they become effectively redundant. And we may be closer to that point than many people understand.
Two very quick points. One is, I think it's important to emphasize that the Soviet Union or the Red Army liberated and saved Poland, because I believe that Poland was number three on the genocidal hit list, the Germans' genocidal hit list. I believe that the Jews were obviously number one. The Roma, or what is sometimes called the Gypsies, were number two. And I believe the Poles were number three. And there were a variety of statements that were made by German leaders that made it clear that they wanted to eliminate every Pole from the face of the earth if they could. And the Soviets saved them, I believe. And I would also note that the reason the Soviets stayed in Europe during the Cold War was in large part because of the German problem. You want to remember when 1945 comes and the war ends, the Soviets have just fought one of the most disastrous wars in modern history. Their losses are just almost unimaginable. And the reason they want to stay in Germany and they're not leaving is they don't want Germany to come back from the dead. And you want to remember, we stay on one side and they stay on the other side. Germany remains divided throughout the Cold War because Germany was a serious threat, certainly a serious threat to come back from the dead in the 40s, late 40s, 50s, and even in the 60s. You just don't want to lose sight of that. It wasn't that the Russians were just sort of mindless aggressors who were trying to conquer all of Europe. They had a German problem to solve. The other point that I would make is I think one of the reasons that the Poles, the Baltic states, even the Finns and the Swedes have turned into real hardliners against the Russians is that they feel secure or have felt secure under the American security umbrella. As long as you have NATO there, as long as the Americans are there in force to protect you, you can poke the Russians in the eye. Sikorsky can poke the Russians with his stick in the eyes, and the Russians can't do much about it because the Americans are there. But the great danger that the Europeans face is that the Americans will go home. Trump has powerful inclinations in that direction. And if the Americans go home and those Eastern European countries are left on their own to deal with the Russians, it is not likely to be a pretty situation. So I think the Europeans should think long and hard about how to deal with the Russians in the context of the possibility that the United States might pull almost all, if not all, its combat troops out of Europe in the future.
Yeah, well, I think that's the dilemma for the Europeans, because there was an article in Reuters, I think, suggesting that at the end of August, the Americans informed the Europeans that they were planning to reduce their presence in the Baltic states. And suddenly, now every day, every drone we see near an airport is evidence of Russian hostility and reason why I have to go to war. Even after we find out who flew them, one of our own citizens, the arrested, we still talk about the hybrid war. So this attempt now of this threat inflation to go harder against the Russians, all of this is aimed at, of course, pulling the Americans back in. Mm-hmm. But it's a big gamble, because if the Americans are leaving and everything indicates that they want to reduce their presence, then we're left without our backup, essentially. And I think you're very correct. None of the Europeans would do anything like this if the Americans didn't stand behind them. So, no, I think we're walking into a disaster. But it's hard. For anyone following the European media, it's like all our leaders are cosplaying World War II. They really do think that this is their great moment when they will go into history books for standing up against our new Hitler. So, Noyce, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I think John is absolutely right. If the Americans are leaving, and of course, it is inevitable that someday they will, but it is more likely than not, probably, that they will leave relatively soon. Then we in Europe need to sort out our relations with the Russians whilst they are still here. And that ought to be a priority. But again, the quality of European leadership is so bad that at the moment we don't seem to be able to do this. I have to say, I think we're going to see a Russian military victory in Ukraine. I think there will be a deep crisis in Europe. I think despite that, probably the Americans will eventually leave, because they've been in Europe for a very long time, far longer than we could have reasonably expected that they would be when this all began. And they have many, many things of their own to sort out, and they're not directly threatened. And then perhaps finally, confronted with the reality of the crisis we face, we in Europe might do something about it in order, and might make a serious effort to sort it out. But I'm afraid that's probably where we're going, because I don't myself see much sign that we're going to be able to do anything else.
Yeah, I have nothing to say other than I agree with everything Alexander said.
Well, that's thank you both for taking the time, and yeah, hope to see you again very, very soon. So thanks.
You're more than welcome, Glenn. I enjoyed it thoroughly.